Blog Talk Radio.
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
Yes, don't be a fool. Don't sneaky with that dial. Keep it tuned to Rich Ross alive. Get the massage.
Oh, listen here, Pilgrim, and listen good. Why don't you mosey on over and set that down to Rich Rossi life? When it comes to Christian talk, he'll wrestle you up a show with true grit.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. Glad you joined us today. We're going to be discussing the book, The Campus Cure, Mental Health for College Students, with Dr. Marsha Morris. As some of you know, our daughter Karis is at Princeton right now in New Jersey and studying at Princeton Theological Seminary. And many of you have college-age students like us, so we're going to talk about the kind of issues they have dealing with mental health and the kind of challenges they face. And we'll be right back with Dr. Marsha Morris, author of The Campus Cure, back in 20 seconds at Richard Rossi Live.
Hit that. I called the number and said, you're on hold.
Is this Dr. Morris?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Good.
Well, we are live now, and I've really enjoyed your book. We have, as you might have heard in the little quick intro, a daughter at Princeton studying. Did I read that you also have college-age children?
Yes, I do. I have a daughter who's a senior in college, and I have a son who's now in graduate school. He's in his first years of a master's degree. So I'm definitely in the thick of it, of working with students in a college counseling center, but also helping my own children at this time of life.
And I would imagine that the kids that come for counseling, is that probably in most cases the first time they've sought out counseling, and they have to overcome maybe a stigma? When I grew up back east, where there was this real macho thing where I grew up, that you don't admit your problems or go for help. And I remember actually feeling a little ashamed, like someone had seen me going to the counseling center on campus and everything. I'm way past that now, but is this usually a lot of times, if they come for counseling, one of the first times they try to get some help for mental health?
Yes, I do see that. And sometimes what happens is they'll start having symptoms of depression or anxiety, but then wait months or even a year to get help because they feel like it's a weakness and they should be able to deal with it on their own, when in reality it is like a medical condition, it's psychological. And if they can identify the problem early and get help, it really moves things along faster. And I wrote the book for parents so they can help their kids identify problems early on. And parents can be like an early detection system and say, hey, you seem depressed. I would like you to speak with a counselor at the counseling center. It's very important for parents to not have stigma, or, you know, we want parents to be positive about kids getting mental health treatment so small problems don't grow into big ones.
Mm. And those of you listening, this book is called The Campus Cure, A Parent's Guide to Mental Health and Wellness for College Students, Marsha Morris. You mentioned like suggesting counseling if we feel our kids need it. What would you suggest with the fact that sometimes the people that need mental health help, for whatever reason, and this is your area of study, so you I'm sure understand this much better, that the people that seem to need help sometimes, as a result of whatever mental issues they're dealing with, they feel like everyone else is the problem, or I don't need help. You know, the kickback of you know, the kid being upset that you're suggesting that. How do we handle when when someone we want to get mental health help is, you know, rebelling against the idea.
You know, that's a very big issue I see. And it's interesting because for some problems, students might listen. Sometimes, for anxiety, I find they're more likely to seek help because the symptoms are really prominent. But sometimes for problems with drugs and alcohol, it's very hard for parents to convince their kids to get help. And so that can be a challenge. But here's what I would suggest to parents. If they know their child is having a problem and their child won't seek help, what the parents can do themselves is speak with a counselor and get advice about how to handle that situation, get a little more – this counselor can get more information about the family circumstances. One thing I've seen parents do is come to the university and go with the student to the counseling session or the psychiatry session for the first time. Some students are very afraid to go see a mental health professional. So just physically coming and saying, just let's try this out once, let's see, can – be enough to catalyze a student to get help.
I like that because it's an experiment and they don't feel like they're locking in.
Right.
You have some very practical questions in your book. You say here to ask how your child is doing in school. How are they sleeping? How are they eating? If he does not admit to being depressed, you can encourage a visit to a campus therapist who can evaluate him. If there is a family history of depression, be open about it and emphasize the importance of treatment. This is so important. I lost my youngest brother this past year. He, and again, we came from a culture where we never ask for help. And, I was the first to ever go into any kind of counseling out of five siblings, but he finally towards the end went for counseling and help for some, struggles he was having with drugs. Unfortunately, we lost my brother. It'll be a year ago next month to an overdose of heroin laced with fentanyl. But he was trying to finally, you know, reach out and get help, which I was very proud of him with, you know, rehab and counseling and groups and things like that. But this book is so important because it's a time when those kind of addiction things crop up, too, with the whole party. The party culture is as a parent, you know, I worry about that because so much of the whole fraternity and parties on campus, and I teach a guitar class at a local college here, and it seems like Monday morning when I just listen to college students talk, it's all about how drunk they were, and I know it's kind of a rite of passage, but, oh, was I hungover and blah, blah, and it's almost like a peer thing to brag about being, you know, drunk and stoned, and I can't remember what happened. I blacked out. Did I sleep with someone? And it's almost like this bragging right or something like that. This must be a major thing to have some concern and intervention about, I would think, is how, and particularly with young women, where sometimes the men are just trying to apply them with alcohol and everything else.
Right, and there actually was a study that addressed the issue of how parents do talk with their children about alcohol, and it did show that starting in high school, talking about, you know, the dangers of binge drinking, and a binge is four drinks for a woman and five drinks for a man, but just talking about the dangers of drinking too much at once, the risks of blacking out, and telling your child, I want you to limit how much you drink. Sometimes saying don't drink at all in college may not be realistic because two-thirds of college students drink, but saying you should limit the amount and be very careful. And also the other thing that helps reduce alcohol, the amount students are drinking, is to be an accessible parent where if your child it needs to reach you, they know how to reach you, and that there is contact with the parent. And the third thing is checking in with, it's called monitoring, but literally checking in with your child and say, what are you doing on a Saturday night? Like actually asking the questions. I'm not saying it's foolproof, but a study did show it reduced the amount of alcohol. But parents need to get the conversation going, even in middle school, I would say, about both drugs and alcohol and talking about risk, not in a judgmental or moralistic way, but talking about in terms of a health and safety way.
I like that. Yeah, you say in your book, as you just stated, two-thirds drank in the past month, college students, and one-third binge drank in the last 2 weeks. Wow. You mentioned the drugs use, 18.6% in a 30-day period used marijuana. Now, here in California, it's kind of a weird culture when it comes to marijuana because the more kind of liberal progressive people have all pushed about no problem with marijuana, you know, we should all be like walking around smoking a joint. But yet those same folks, if I light up a cigar, which I occasionally have, that's horrible. It's a really weird thing now where marijuana is seen as practically as harmless. But it's interesting, in your book, you seem to suggest very strongly to try to keep our kids away from it while they're at college. Am I interpreting that right?
Oh, you are correct in your interpretation. What I've seen in my over two decades of working with students is, and what I've read in studies is, marijuana, regular use more than like two times a week, just frequent smoking, really does decrease motivation, decreases the GPA, and decreases graduation rates. People will always cite exceptions and say, well, I know someone who smoked every day and did fine, but that's not the majority of people who smoke regularly. It really does interfere with school. Studies do demonstrate it interferes with memory, and it can actually affect the brain's development. The brain is developing until around age 25. So the point I try to make in the book is any drug, not just marijuana, but drugs in the adolescent brain are not a good thing for brain development. So the longer we can keep our kids away from drugs and alcohol, the better. And ideally, they'll have minimal amounts of alcohol and no drugs. And again, for some people, alcohol is not a good thing either, and they can't handle it. Some people should just have no drugs or alcohol. But marijuana, as you stated, is not benign for everyone, and especially the younger someone smokes it, the more harmful it is. So we have to, you know, guide our children and give them the facts about this issue.
Well, your book does a great job. The Campus Cure is the book we're discussing, if you just tuned in, by Dr. Marsha Morris. You also get into the more severe disorders, bipolar and one, bipolar two. I come from a family who have bipolar running throughout our history. My father was in and out of mental hospitals for bipolar. From what I've read, it seems like most people that may suffer bipolar, there tends to be sometimes some sort of indications or episodes younger. So by college, would there be signs for most people if they suffer that?
Well, what happens for most mental health problems, whether it's depression or bipolar disorder or a psychotic disorder, 3/4 of mental health disorders emerge before age 24. Mm-hmm. So it is, the college is the prime time when you might see symptoms of these events emerge. For some reason, freshman year is the big time, maybe because people, it's the stress of moving away, especially for psychotic disorders. Mm-hmm. So, so there are combinations of reasons. It's the biological part that this is when these things develop, and also the stress of leaving home for the first time, having academic stress, and also being around drugs and alcohol, which can make these kinds of problems worse. So parents definitely need to be on the lookout for these kinds of problems. And I'm not saying everyone has a problem, but the studies do show 31% of college students have been diagnosed with or treated for a mental health disorder in the last year. So it's likely a parent might run into some of these issues along the way. And the good news is these conditions are highly treatable with good lifestyle habits, therapy, and sometimes medication. So there's, you know, this, I feel very hopeful about the work I do, but we just have to get students in sooner before the problems get really serious.
Yeah, you talk about some psychotic episodes in your book. One was offered cocaine and then becomes paranoid, shouting, and eventually brought to the ER by police. I have a friend who has a son that had a psychotic episode while in college and It derailed them
yes.
for a little while, and now they're back in school, and they seem to be doing better. This is a really important time to be aware of all these things. So do you run where you work? Is there a group of counselors? Because I would imagine at a college, you're at the University of Florida, that there's just hundreds or thousands of students. So I imagine you'd have to have multiple counselors, right?
We do. We have a very large counseling center, and we also have psychiatrists who are part of the student health care center but housed within the counseling center. So we do have a large group of providers. One interesting thing, though, is that even though we do have a large group of providers, it's still not always enough to help everyone on campus. And that's one thing I point out in my book. It's sometimes schools just can't have enough for everybody. So what schools are doing now is hiring case managers or social workers who can refer someone to the community. If let's say they need to get seen every week for therapy, some counseling centers just can't do that for every student. So they can get a referral into the community and get help there. So we do serve a lot of students, but sometimes because we have so many students on campus, we do refer people out. And again, that's where parents can be very helpful, especially if someone is referred out, to help the student deal with the insurance process and getting an appointment. Because when their student, let's say, is depressed, they may not have the motivation to make an appointment. So this is a time for parents to step in and get the process moving.
How, if a student has one of these episodes and has felt a stigma, maybe let's say in the case you mentioned Dixon that was psychotic, or another one, Anna, that you mentioned in your book, was hearing voices. So let's say they do something like Dixon and they're in trouble with the campus police, and all of a sudden they feel like this scarlet letter on them is crazy, or maybe they even got arrested. And they feel like, oh, my God, I'm, 20 years old and my future is doomed by this bad record or this incident. What would you say to try to get someone like that on track? We do have a mother listening in that's had a son in school that had an arrest or two and some psychotic episodes, and now feels like, well, how am I going to even, who's going to even want me in school or at a job because now I have this kind of record of being crazy and having an arrest record and all that stuff. What would you say to someone that's had that kind of episode to get them back on track?
Well, first I can say I know people. I just know people who've had those kinds of events, and with the right help, they were able to get back on track and finish school. But I know it's not easy. And what I would say is there have been studies, several new studies that show the important part to recovery from psychosis is getting comprehensive care that does include working with a therapist, a psychiatrist, and someone who does either vocational training or educational training. If the student is in school, they do have something called a disability resource center, and it's for students with both physical and mental health issues. And they get some extra coaching. They might be able to take a reduced course load. So if someone is recovering from a psychotic episode, they don't have to take 4 courses. They could take 2 and just take longer to graduate. It sometimes makes sense for a student maybe to stay at home while they're recovering, and they could do some classes at a community college. Yes, absolutely. But these studies show also families being involved with treatment and having the opportunity to meet with the patient's therapist or psychiatrist, not every time, but to work collaboratively and work on a plan can make a very, very big difference in long-term recovery and in future functioning.
It's interesting, too, the compassion for what a lot of these students and mental health sufferers have been through. You say in your book, bullying, sexual abuse, and physical abuse, I'm reading from the book, have strong associations with later episodes of psychosis. In fact, people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder also have high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. That PTSD aspect is so, I don't know. I think it's liberating and comforting to a person to realize. In fact, I had one of my counselors in the past that you know, diagnosed me that way. Like, Richard, you have some really bad PTSD, and that connected a lot of dots and made a lot of sense of, you know, why sometimes because of things in my past there was a hypervigilance and a weird dynamic going on there. So this is very compassionate towards the past. How do you assess in from a layperson's viewpoint? I think what I've understood, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lot of times a psychiatrist is dealing with just prescribing medication, whereas a therapist or psychologist might help with the way you're thinking or cognitive therapy to replace the irrational thoughts with healthier rational thoughts. But how do you assess with students when is the need for, say, an anti-anxiety medication versus just, you know, cognitive therapy or something to help them think in healthier ways?
Right. Well, what we do in our setting, which I think is a good process, is the student will meet with a therapist first, and they'll assess whether therapy is enough or they might need more. And one way to know that is it depends if someone's having severe symptoms where there is a, let's say, you know, kind of suicidal thoughts. I would say at that point, get a psychiatrist involved. It doesn't mean they have to take medicine, but if depression is moderate, you could do therapy, medication, or both. But once it gets severe and there are a lot of symptoms, medication and therapy should be considered. And so, what's interesting, though, is sometimes there's personal preference. Some students prefer, and some patients in general prefer therapy, and some would like to focus on medication. But I would say to all my patients on medication, sometimes I will do some what we call supportive therapy, so a little bit of talk therapy with them, but I generally encourage them to do some therapy because you're right, there can be cognitive distortions and negative thinking with depression, and that needs to be addressed in addition to the biological types of things that are going on. So I think therapy is crucial.
Yes. You mentioned suicide. How do we discern if a friend is serious or when we call 911 or do something drastic? Because in college settings, you know, I've heard, say, female students say something like, I feel hopeless. I don't have a boyfriend. I'm alone. You know, Friday and Saturday nights, and everyone else is going out and has dates, and you know, and I'm sick, and I'm not feeling well, and I'm not doing well at school, and what's the point? And I sometimes feel like I've lost my will to live, but there doesn't seem to be a plan, or you know, I've heard people say if there's a definite plan, that's when you call in the 911 or whatever. But if someone's talking depressed and hopeless, how do we know? Or I guess only God knows. We don't know everything, but what do we do as parents and or as friends of people that might be talking very depressed? And when do you take the action, you know, to try to really intervene?
Right. Yeah, and I talk about that. That's such a great question. I talk about that in my chapter. I think it's chapter 9 on suicidality. But it's very hard. If anyone is, one rule of thumb I would say is if people are expressing hopelessness or suicidal thoughts, they need to see a therapist or a counselor or a psychiatrist soon. The question is, I think the big question is how soon, but they need to promise and get an appointment and see someone, I'd say within a week or two. But then the question is, when is it imminent? How do you know they're about to do something? And that is the hardest thing. And if psychiatrists could do that, if mental health professionals could do that perfectly, we'd have a lower suicide rate. So it's very hard to predict, but doing things like giving things away, precious objects away, giving a pet away, selling off things, not making plans for the future, or crying a lot, or just not taking care of yourself, not sleep, not eating, not drinking water, just a general deterioration are very concerning things. What I would say is you also have to listen to your instincts. And what you can do is usually a community has a crisis center. So you can offer to go with your friend or, you know, to a crisis center. On campus, there are usually walk-in clinics where students can literally walk in and get seen that day. So if parents are concerned, they can say, we want you to see someone that day. We want you to walk in. They also can call in a college setting. They can call the dean of students office. And if there's a serious concern about suicide, the dean of students office will check on the student. So there are measures. If parents can't always rely on what their kids say, so sometimes they need to step in and, like I said, come visit and see the student. Say, I'm really worried. I'm going to come and see you. But it is a tough thing. But I would say err on the side of caution and come visit and check on the person. But if someone's threatening suicide, then you need to call the police. If something imminent is happening, it's important to get immediate help.
Mm. And the friends tend to sometimes, they don't have a lot of life experience yet if this isn't a college setting. And so some of them, you know, just being kind hearts get sucked in. I remember in college, I had a friend, and he was kind of like an old, this might be before your time, there's an old movie called Harold and Maude, where this eccentric young man in his 20s does all these fake suicide attempts for attention. And it's a very black sense of humor, very dark sense of humor, and it's an acquired taste. But, you know, he does all these, it becomes more and more elaborate suicide attempts, and his mother just kind of rolls her eyes because it's always a cry for attention. I had a friend like that in college, and being a kind of codependent, bleeding heart, I got sucked into all these dramas constantly of trying to, you know, rescue him and make sure he didn't kill himself and things like that. So, you know, how do the other students, you know, when do they know that this is a friend thing, that, you know, just be a listening ear and a friend versus, you know, you need a counselor and a serious therapist?
Right. Well, what I've seen some students be very proactive and literally come with their friends to the appointment. They may not come to the actual session, but they literally walk with the students to make sure they get there. And I think what I've counseled students who ask me that question, I'm worried about my friend, what do I do? I say you need to get them connected with a mental health professional. You can't be their mental health professional. And sometimes what friends will do is call the parents of the student, which, you know, I think is okay. It's interesting because colleges have to be careful about that. They can't always call unless a patient is imminently in danger. But certainly a friend can pick up the phone and call the parent and say, I'm really concerned about your child. But the student, if a student on campus is worried about a friend, they can call the counseling center and consult, what do I do in this situation? And, so I'm trying to give some suggestions, but sometimes a person needs to consult in the moment with a therapist to see, what do I do next in this situation?
Yeah, and they can maybe even do that with a phone call, perhaps.
Exactly.
And as you said in your book, those of you listening, since our time's winding down here, Chapter 9 of Dr. Marsha Morris's our guest book is called The Campus Cure, Chapter 9, Suicidal Behaviors, A Parent's Worst Fear. Well, I guess as we're winding down here on maybe a lighter note, or maybe it's not a lighter note, it might be just as heavy for some people, the whole dating thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of ties to depression with Valentine's Day. Now, as a man, I didn't quite get this, but a lot of the female students that I know are dreading Valentine's Day, you know, because, you know, us guys, I mean, yeah, I felt loneliness, you know, as a single man, of course. I got married at age 21 while in college. My wife and I got married in college
way
back in 1984. But I remember my freshman year or so and just feeling a little bit lonely when I'd see couples and I wasn't with somebody. But for the female students, it seems very pronounced, and I've heard several of them say they are dreading Valentine's Day coming up, when they see all the social media posts and all these couples gushing, "I love you the first time I saw you in the school cafeteria, and it's been a wonderful 6 months," and, you know, and all the people, and they're sitting in their dorm room and they don't have a date. And the whole dating thing, and I guess it kind of relates back to the suicide, because if a student gets really attached romantically, it can really seem to derail their academic path, and then when the breakup happens, can really throw them for a loop emotionally and mentally. Or now with cell phones, it seems like people expect almost 24/7 access, and I'll hear students say, "Oh my God, I'm just so sad. What's wrong? Well, this guy like hasn't returned my text. It's been a really long time." Well, how long has it been? It's been a whole hour. You know, like they almost expect like 24/7. They're hiding their phones in their textbook store in class, and they feel like they have to constantly connect. And this whole dating thing is, I imagine, something that you have to hear a lot as a counselor.
Oh, students are developing their sense of what they want in a relationship, and social media makes things much more complicated and interesting. And you're right. Sometimes a student will say, "I fought with my boyfriend," and I said, "Oh, what did you guys say to each other?" "Oh, we texted." So
yeah,
a lot is done through texting as opposed to face-to-face contact. But what I would say, and I see this a lot with students who may be heartbroken after a breakup, but what I do is I encourage students to make sure they don't put so-called all their eggs in one basket in that relationship. And really, they have to realize one person can't fulfill all their needs. And we all need to realize that, all adults. And that you can have a boyfriend or girlfriend, but you also have to have friends. Every person, you can have friends who fulfill different kinds of needs. And the mistake I see young adults make is putting all getting overly involved and romantic about this one person, when in reality it's important to have love in other areas in your life. So what I would say to a woman who's feeling lonely or a man who's feeling lonely is go out with your friends and celebrate your friendship on Valentine's Day. And I have friends, single female friends, who went out with a group of women and celebrated. So it doesn't have to be a sad time. We can, you know, have fun, and, you know, we can't make this one relationship the most important thing. We have to have a series of relationships. We have to have social connections with a variety of people. That's what I would say.
Very good advice. Well, what would your final words be to all the parents listening that, you know, just want to support their kid, and maybe their child's doing pretty well in school, there's no major signs of issues, but just to be aware and be supportive, especially if they're, in our case, we're in Los Angeles and our daughter's in Princeton in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how can we best support them psychologically?
Well, and I do think it's a good idea to keep in touch by phone or text or whatever works, but regular contact is important. And if your kid is far away, to go and visit, you know, for Parents' Weekend. But in general, I mean, I know this book has, you know, it talks about some of the problems, but parents should enjoy these years. It's amazing to watch your kids grow up and develop, and it's important for parents to focus on the positive and say, notice the changes you're seeing. Like, wow, I love the way you handle the financial aid office. You're real, you know, see how they're growing, or they got a summer job and they're developing leadership skills. So we want to be looking out for the problems, because we don't want them to derail our kids, but giving a lot of positive reinforcement is really important. Or even if a kid gets a C, saying, you know, that's okay, that happens, but what can you do to, you know, what can we talk about, who can you talk to help next time? But trying to stay positive is so important with our children. We don't want to be critiquing them all the time. They need our love and support.
Yeah, the perfectionism is really terrible, and we talked about some dark things like suicide. One friend of mine that did commit suicide,
was
terrible perfectionism. And in his case, we didn't see it coming. He acted like everything was fine, no sign.
Oh, wow.
I remember sometimes him in the past, him talking about his dad and getting emotional and breaking down about how perfectionistic, if he didn't get all A's, you know. And he told a poignant story to me one time about his dad wanting him to paint a shed, and he worked so hard as a, you know, kid, and he missed one little, you know, 1/4-inch spot on the shed or something, and the dads went right to that and bawled them out. They didn't quite do that one little spot right. And it was kind of like a microcosm of the perfectionism that seemed to haunt this guy.
And that perfectionism, I have a chapter in my book on that, and how it's we can never be perfect. So I don't like the word perfectionism. We can aim for excellence, but we can, you know, we are going to make ourselves miserable if we're always trying to be perfect. And that's where, again, the parents come in and give balance and say, I want you to do well in school, but I want you to exercise and take care of yourself and have friends. So parents can be the ones to give the balance when often society is kind of driving us to succeed and achieve. We have to have, you know, balance, friendship, and fun in our lives. It's very important.
Yeah, you call it the duck syndrome, perfectionism. I like your description. Mm-hmm. Duck syndrome, first used at Stanford to describe students who feel they must appear perfectly together on the outside, no matter how stressed they feel on the inside, like ducks that appear to effortlessly glide on water while paddling furiously below the surface. Students are under increasing pressure to maintain a facade of perfection, receiving high grades, having a busy social life, looking great, all while appearing calm and collected. Well, humor helps, too, when our daughter got her a ticket to visit us for Christmas, and she's a blonde, was a charismatic social butterfly type, and she's at this Ivy League school. So I said, you know what we're doing? During watching Legally Blonde. Is it Legally Blonde, the one where the blonde goes to campus? And we laughed so hard because she shows up, and she's from California, and all the other, in the orientation, all the other people are in dark clothes, and they're talking about all their scholarly stuff, and she's just, like, talking about L.A. and the beach. And we were laughing so hard because we were able to laugh at the fact that she was kind of a misfit in the sense that she stands out. I said, you're going to get there. There'll be all these kind of nerdy guys carrying like 10 books under their arms, and you're like the California blonde. And we make a joke about, because sometimes fitting in, if there's something different about them, you know, that just being accepted and fitting in is an issue that people have, and that whole peer group and the, you know, so we just laughed about it, you know.
And I think you're right. It's great when your kids are home to sit down and watch a funny movie. And I try to do that with my children. You have to have lightness in your life. It can't always be serious. And that we have to teach our children that as well. And there are a lot of great shows on TV now that make us laugh. So we got a lot to see.
And
so,
how would people keep up with you and your book? What would you suggest would be the best way they can keep up with your work and your writing and what you do and everything?
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I do have a website. It's Marcia, M-A-R-C-I-A, Morris, MD.com. And they can follow me on Facebook and Twitter at Marcia Morris, MD, M-A-R-C-I-A. Okay. And also my Amazon page on the campus, Cure, also has listings. I actually have a blog on Psychology Today called College Wellness. So there's a link on my website and on Amazon to my blog. And I write about every month or two about issues. I would love people to read more and see what I've written in the past. I have some of that on my website. And I got into this because I speak with so many parents in my job. I wanted to get the message out there and even try to prevent some of the suffering I see that kids and parents go through. I want, again, people to get help early on. And again, it's so many great things happen in college, and I just want kids to have the best experience they can in the college years.
Well, I just found your Facebook page, and you have very pretty blue eyes. I say, are they blue?
Yes, they are.
And
a great
smile. So you're not one of these, iconic, psychiatrists that hunched over and, you know, kind of strange looking. You're very photogenic.
Well, I have to defend the psychiatric community. I think there are a lot of, you know, outgoing psychiatrists, but I think it's important to be happy. I'm a happy person. I am. And I want to try to share with my patients how joyful life can be. So I guess that comes through on the picture.
Well, that's a miracle to hear people suffering all day and then have such a happy spirit. And I just found your page, and let me see, click like here. I just liked it. And
oh,
you
wonderful.
Have a link. You have a thing about the interview on there. And by the way, this link, just so you and everyone listening knows, if, I'm sure you have students, some of you listening have students in school or other parents with college-age
mm-hmm.
students. This link now is good to replay this interview because I think it's a very helpful
oh,
all the things you shared.
Well, and I want to thank you for having me, and I'm so pleased that you looked so closely at the book, and I hope people will benefit from our discussion today.
Well, I'm sure they will, and blessings to you and your college student kids, and, you know, I think you and I and both have some good graduations to look forward to. That's going to be
yes,
a big day, isn't
yes.
it, when we see our kids graduate?
Absolutely. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Well, keep up the good work, and we'll keep reading your on Psychology Today as well.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. You take care.
You too, Dr. Morris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you to all of you for listening to our interview with Dr. Marcia Morris. Her book, The Campus Cure, is available on Amazon, wherever books are sold. The Campus Cure, A Parent Guide to Mental Health and Wellness for College Students. Thanks for tuning in. God bless.